Are you a mom or a mom-to-be looking for tips to make wearing your mom hat a little easier? Hoping to become as smart about motherhood as you can be? Then you've found the podcast that leaves you a little smarter than before every time you listen to one of our expert guests. I'm cognitive psychologist and child development specialist, Dr. Amy Moore. Join us on a quest to becoming a brainy mom. Hi, and welcome to this episode of Brainy Moms, brought to you today by LearningRx Brain Training Centers. I am your host, Dr. Amy Moore, here with my co-host, Dr. Jody Jedlicka, and we're coming to you today from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Dr. Jody and I are super excited to welcome our guest today, Dr. Emeka Obidi. Dr. Obidi is a board-certified pediatrician practicing in Maryland, where he owns a multi-provider family practice. He's also the CEO of Newborn Prep Academy, where he runs an online newborn preparation course that helps new and expectant moms understand how to care for their newborn baby so they can feel confident, empowered, and joyful. He's here today to address some common worries new moms have and to talk about ways to develop confidence in being a new mom.
Welcome, Dr. Obidi. This is a topic that is so valuable for new moms and soon-to-be moms. But before we dig in, why don't you give our listeners a little background about you, what you do, and how you ended up doing what you're doing?
Sure. Thank you so very much for having me on, Drs. Amy and Jody. I really appreciate this time with you guys. So like you said, I'm Dr. Obidi, and I practice in Western Maryland. I'm a pediatrician. I actually wanted to be an ophthalmologist when I was in med school. I just found the eye very fascinating. But during my pediatric rotation, I just fell in love with pediatrics. It just stole my heart. And so I knew this is what I was going to do. So I did a pediatric residency out in New York, and I have been practicing out in Western Maryland for about 17 years. And I think more recently, just started to really be attuned to the fact that although I love all of pediatrics and I really enjoy caring for kids, it's crazy. I've been doing this so long now that I have moms who now have their babies bringing them back to me. I'm like, no, I'm not that old. but I just realized I really enjoy that interaction with a new mom and her baby. Like, it just lights me up, lights up my day. I get to be part of that journey, get to sort of help her during a very trying time. Caring for a newborn can be tasking. And so just leaned more into that and just realizing that I had something to offer, just given the number of years I've done this and the number of moms have helped care for their babies.
And so what do you see or hear the most in terms of what moms, new moms and expectant moms are worried about? What are some of those common worries and what are your responses?
Yeah, no, there are quite a number of them. I think sometimes, well, if you start really earlier on from right after baby's born, because I get to, in a local area I practice, I get to visit them at the hospital when baby's born. So I get to see them those first day or two or 3 days while they're still at the hospital. And a lot of moms are, and this is something that most moms are not even aware of, really can be worried when they realize their babies have lost weight the second day after delivery. As is usually the case with a lot of moms, they immediately start to blame themselves. I am not feeding this baby enough. There's something wrong. I don't have enough breast milk. And, you know, a number of reasons along those lines. So that's something that comes up. So I get to be able to say, no, you haven't done anything wrong. This is just part of what's normal. Your baby actually comes with some extra on board, some extra calories on board, as it were, for this trip. You can imagine how uncomfortable it will be for a mom to have to carry a breast full of milk throughout her pregnancy, right? So that production doesn't start until after your baby comes and starts to, you know, suck at your nipples and which sets up a whole cascade of hormones that end up producing milk. And so during that period that it takes 1 to 2, 3 days for you to get to full milk production, your baby comes prepared for that. And so that's just nature. So if you have a normal newborn where there aren't any other issues going on, it is going to be typical for them to lose weight a few days. They are actually allowed to lose up to 10% of their birth weight before we worry. And that's enough time for a mom to get to produce milk and for that to ramp back up so that by day 7 to 10, they're back to their birth weight. That would be one common concern I see pretty early on.
So let me ask a couple questions about that. Do we see that same weight loss with moms who choose to formula feed right away?
That's actually a great question. You do, but it's not as much, and it's a shorter turnaround time. So oftentimes, there may still be some weight loss that first day, because also the stomachs are only small, really tiny. There's only so much milk that can go in there, typically 1 ounce, maybe even half an ounce that first day or two. So it does take another day or two before they start to put back on weight, but it is a quicker weight gain than if you're breastfeeding.
And so along those lines, so we know that if you're breastfeeding, your baby gets colostrum for those first couple of days while waiting for the milk to come in. So why do we give, for moms who formula feed, why does the hospital automatically start formula right away if the baby is physically, biologically prepared to wait?
Yeah.
Why is that what the procedure?
Yeah, and I think it does depend on the hospital and might depend on how supportive they are breastfeeding. Might even depend on the particular, even if hospital-wide they have a policy to really encourage breastfeeding as much as possible. It might depend on the particular nurse or the particular lactation consultant even. And then some of it may also be mom's preference as well and how educated she is, right? Because if she feels that, well, she's doing something wrong and her baby is losing weight as a result, it's more likely to say, you know what, I give up, let's do formula. I really want to breastfeed, but I want to make sure my baby is getting enough, so let's formula feed. But if she knows that this is just, you know, part of nature and that her baby is fine, her colostrum has quite a good amount of calories in it, so even though you're getting a small amount, teaspoons usually, there's still quite a number of calories in there, then she's probably better able to sort of weather those first few days of a baby losing some weight and not getting as much volume-wise. Yeah, I think there's a lot of it has to do with just the environment, how supportive they are, education.
So what if you, and I'm taking all the conversation, Dr. Jody, I'm sorry about that. So I just have all these questions. Right. What about a mom who's planning to do a home birth? Mm-hmm. So what advice do you give to her? What if she says, hey, I want to do a home birth. I want to do everything as natural as possible, but I'm not interested in breastfeeding for whatever reason. Then what is your advice to her on how she starts feeding the baby from minute one?
Yeah. So, I mean, you typically would want to feed the baby within that first hour. And the earlier you feed them within that hour, the better. And so for moms, it would be great to start to breastfeed within 30 minutes, right? And of course, all this is going to depend on the circumstances of birth and if it's stable, if the baby is stable and all of that. If a mom is going to be, there's going to be a home birth, they really, I wouldn't say is necessarily any special instruction or advice other than just start to feed. Now, I will say, which also is another question that moms often have when they do decide they want a formula feed is, what formula? You know, you go to the store, there's like 1,001 of them, right? They're all kinds of brands, everything out there. And so that's a big question. And I usually say just anyone is fine, honestly. It's quite a regulated industry. So they all have about the same amounts of carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. They may have different kinds of probiotics they put in there to try and simulate breast milk. They may have different kinds of fats and proteins, but they're all about the same. They all provide the same amount of calories. You do have some higher calorie formulas for special situations where you want babies to gain, where you want to provide more calories. But the run-of-the-mill formula is just fine. Even the store brand formula would do just fine. And that's usually very freeing, especially with the formula shortages we've had recently. Just know you can get anything. And so back to your question, I say just pick whatever formula you have. Oftentimes, most moms are going to have free samples that have been given. and just start there.
I have children who have children, so I have grandchildren, and both of my daughter and my daughter-in-law struggled with the whole decision, do I breastfeed or do I formula feed? And there was so much guilt involved in, you know, trying to make that decision. What kind of advice do you give to new moms who just are, you know, they feel so deeply that they should do it one way, but they're comfortable doing it a different way? What kind of advice do you give parents?
Yeah, I think it all comes back to the, I'm not even sure what to call it, maybe the bane of every mom with mom guilt, where you just really feel like you're doing it wrong. It doesn't matter what way you decide to go, you're doing it wrong. Everyone else is doing it better than you are. I think it's such a very personal decision, honestly, what you feed your baby. Breast milk definitely has lots of advantages over formula. But I don't think those advantages so outweigh feeding with formula that it now becomes such a terrible choice should you decide to formula feed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it really goes back to trying to figure out what works best for you and knowing that either way, you're going to have a baby who's healthy, right? And if you can breastfeed, great, go for it. And oftentimes, I think that some moms would love to breastfeed, but there's just a fear that it might not work well, or it might not, or they're just worried. What if I, you know, I try to and it doesn't go well? What do I do? Do I feel like I failed because now I have to, like, you know, change course and formula feed? I think if you just give yourself grace and just the freedom to try it, mm-hmm. and to know that it's okay to change your mind should you decide to do something else. You might have more moms adopting to breastfeed initially. And I can imagine that's not easy, but really deciding that, and this is part of what I teach with the confident mom mindset, that you're in charge of the baby's care. Nobody else gets to decide that but you. And so you sort of really have to be in tune with, because the truth is, you know, the more authentic you are in what you believe and how you want to show up, the better you are going to be available for your baby and for your child, and the better you'll show up, the more confident you'll be mothering them. So I think you're at the end of the day better off going with what feels true to you, and then having the freedom to change your mind if you decide to.
Mm-hmm.
I love that advice.
I do too.
Just not caring what everybody else is saying in this year and in this year, but what feels right for you, what feels right.
And I will say, I'm sorry.
No, you got it.
What I was going to say, only because this is really, really important. Over the years, I've also seen lots of moms who really wanted to breastfeed, were committed to breastfeeding, but that didn't go well. Either the babies didn't latch, they really had a difficult time latching, or there was some real significant issue with milk production, or whatever reason, maybe they had a procedure they had to do that interrupted the whole process, or the baby had to go into the NICU that interrupted the process, and there wasn't sort of enough support to get breastfeeding going. Those moms have often had a really difficult time because this is something I really wanted to do, something I was really vested in doing, and it's not working out. And that can be really heart-wrenching to see also, because you can see that it really hits in a very deep place. And I just want to say that should happen to a mom listening, to give yourself some grace. Allow yourself grief through the period, because I think there is some real grief that happens there, because this is something you felt really strongly about, but for some reason it's not working out. And I think allowing yourself to go through that grief and allowing yourself to the freedom to give yourself grace and say, you know what, this is not the end of the world. I can still formula feed. My baby's still going to be fine and still healthy. I think can help through what can be often a very difficult period when that doesn't work out quite the way you wanted it to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I had, and every baby's different, right? Like if you have a negative experience with one, that doesn't mean you're going to have a negative experience with the next one, right? Like my middle child, first child was fine breastfeeding. Second child, at day 10, some strange thing kicked in and he started, I don't want to scare anybody. He started sucking so hard that he would draw blood and then spit it up. Right. And I was in a place where I didn't have any lactation support. We were in the middle of a move and it just was overwhelming to me. Right. Like this baby would, I mean, it was right. And so I just said, okay, forget it. We're just going to formula feed because I don't know what to do. Yeah. At this point, right? And so, but then the third one came along, everything was fine again. And so that would be my encouragement that what happens with one is not necessarily going to happen with the next. So,
very true.
But if you have problems like that, you can call your pediatrician, you can call a lactation consultant at the hospital, right? I mean, those resources.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are more and more resources now. There are more. Pediatricians are becoming more and more comfortable guiding the mom through that. Lots of hospitals, I dare say maybe almost all, have someone, either a lactation consultant or the nurses have been trained, just to be able to provide breastfeeding support. So I think there are more resources, certainly out in the community. And of course, good resources online also, right? Providing the same information as well.
Sure. Yeah, see, this was 20-something years ago.
Yes.
So
yes.
Yeah. And mine was 30 something years ago. So I do remember feeling prepared to have a baby. But once my oldest child was born, I remember thinking this is so much harder than I thought it was. And a lot of the thought it was going to be. And a lot of the things were just like health related things that I worried about. And I love how the resources that you provide just kind of put your mind at ease. So can you give us some of those resources or some of those thoughts that you that you're there to help people with so that they understand this is normal or it's not normal, this is when you should seek help, this is when it's okay?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of things. I think there's maybe three big things to sort of be mindful of, to sort of have your radar or antenna go up if that's what happened. The first will be fever here. The first will be a fever. And so a fever for a newborn is a rectal temperature more than 100.4. So which can also in and of itself be like, really that high? Yeah, so a baby who has a rectal temperature of 100.1, 100.2, 100.4, that's still normal. Now, if it's 100.5 or above, that's abnormal. And in the first month of life, something we take very seriously because their immune systems are still very fragile. And so they do not necessarily mount the sort of immune response you'll have if you and I come down with a significant bug where we feel really ill, right? So they could look like they have just a cold, but have meningitis, right? And so it's difficult to know what's a minor illness and what's a significant illness when a newborn has just a fever. And so that's something you want to bring to your pediatrician or to nearest emergency room so they can evaluate a little better and decide what may need to be done in terms of walking up to see what the cause is. So that'll be one. Another will be...
Wait, let me just reiterate that.
Sure.
Anything, so 100.5 or higher, you need to call the doctor. Rectally. Immediately?
Rectally, yes.
Rectally.
In that first month of life, yes.
Okay.
In the first month of life, you don't want to take that seriously. When they're much older, you can sort of see how they're doing. If they look comfortable, they're not breathing funny, you know, you could probably watch. I would certainly reach out to your pediatrician and just sort of let them know what's going on. But certainly in the first month of life, you do want to reach out any fever whatsoever.
Okay.
Yep. And another would be just difficulty breathing, right? So if you have sustained fast breathing, that will be something to worry about. Newborns have this breathing pattern called periodic breathing that can look scary to a mom also or parents when it happens, but it's part of the normal course of their respiratory system and respiratory drive developing. And so they're breathing very normally, and then they pause for a few seconds, and then they pick back up and breathe very fast, and then settles down again, right? So it's sort of all over the place, and it happens several times during the day, but that's normal. Part of this normal development. But if you have a baby who's breathing very fast and is sustained, that'll be something else to worry about and certainly bring up to the medical provider to evaluate you a little better.
Yeah. What could be happening to make a newborn have sustained rapid breathing?
Sure. So a respiratory illness, so they have a pneumonia, for instance, that will be something that can cause that. If they have some overwhelming infections or some sepsis where there's a systemic involvement, all of their body systems, that can also cause that as well, where they're breathing very fast. There are some genetic conditions or metabolic conditions that may be congenital that they're born with, where at that stage in its symptomatology that they are breathing that fast. So a number of things that could cause that. That's why you do want someone to evaluate to make sure, to figure out what's going on.
Okay. Yeah. And the third?
And the third will be persistent vomiting. So, which is also can be something else that can be worrisome also when a baby vomits maybe just once or twice, because sometimes it can be a lot. So it can be like, oh my God, everything just came up. But if they look comfortable, just one here or there, that's less worrisome than if you have a persistent vomiting. So no sooner have they taken something, it all comes out again, especially if it comes out very forcefully. But it is pretty common for newborns to speed up, where it's a very effortless sort of bringing up of substance from the mouth. That's usually not much of a problem. If it is happening frequently, you may still want to see a pediatrician to figure out if there's some reflux and if it's significant enough to be treated. But just spitting up here and there or vomit here and there is less worrisome than a persistent vomiting, because that'll be something else also that can speak to something more significant going on, whether it's a GI obstruction, gastrointestinal obstruction, or even also sepsis can cause that as well. Just really significant conditions that can cause persistent vomiting. Yeah, so those would be maybe three big ones I tend to sort of bring up with parents to watch for.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about circumcision. Mm-hmm. So when I was pregnant with my first 24 years ago, my sister-in-law was also pregnant at the same time. We were both having boys. She was living in California. I was living in South Carolina. And at the time, nobody in California was circumcising. Mm-hmm. And so she was trying to tell me, you know, we're not going to do this. You shouldn't do this either. So I asked my OB, because mm-hmm. it's usually the OB that does it, right?
Yes,
so I asked the OB, what percentage of newborn boys do you circumcise? And he paused and he looked at me and in his deepest Southern accent says, well, 100% of okay. So California's not doing it. South Carolina is doing it at 100%. And I know that that pendulum has swung back and forth and back and forth over the years. Yeah. What do you say to an expectant mom who says, should we circumcise or not?
I think do whatever you feel like doing. Because I think at the end of the day, really, it's one of those things where is there some advantage to circumcising? Yes, there may be some slight decrease in their ability to contract a sexually transmitted disease, maybe some rare cancer that males could have, genital cancers they could have, maybe a slightly decreased incidence of that among circumcised males. But again, those percentages and those advantages are so small when you take a look population-wise that at the end of the day, it probably doesn't really matter if you decide to circumcise or not. I think that's why the current recommendation is sort of, it's a personal preference, really. Personal preference or religious preference. And at the end of the day, it's probably doesn't matter much, honestly.
Not an overwhelming medical benefit.
Yes, not an overwhelming medical benefit to strongly suggest that you circumcise. So at the end of the day, I think whatever you feel comfortable doing is fine. Yeah.
Okay.
I will say along those lines, you know, just talking about circumcision, but that's something else that oftentimes if you do decide to circumcise, that healing process sometimes can also look like there's something wrong, because at some point during the healing process, you can have some what they call slough material, just some yellow, sticky, gooey stuff that can be attached to the head of the penis that can look like pus and look like there's something wrong. And so that's oftentimes something that moms will bring up also, saying, oh, I think there's something wrong. You know, this looks weird. But oftentimes it's also normal. And but again, anything you're worried about, you should definitely bring up to your medical provider. But it's information I like to provide ahead of time. So even in the time period you're waiting to see someone, you're not stressing out over it. If you have an indication that it's probably less of an issue than it looks like.
I wonder if you can settle a family disagreement for me.
Oh boy, yeah, go in trouble now.
It's almost like humorous, but my mom always worries so much about babies being cold, and they can't move around. They can't, you know, when we move around, we get warmer, but she is just bundling babies up with hats and socks and blankets, and it's 90 degrees out. And we're like, Mom, stop. So do babies run cold? Do they run warm? How do you judge that?
Let me tell you this funny story, first of all. So years ago, I went to Haiti for a medical missions trip. This is probably about 6 years ago. And just precious, precious people. I think I left a little bit of my heart there. So it was an outside sort of tent that was set up by this organization. And so they had a bunch of doctors and medical providers providing help. And the locals were lined up like for hours waiting to be seen. And almost every baby had a sweater on, and a hat on, and bundled up with like blankets. And this is like 100 degrees of temperature. And these babies are screaming, and no sooner do you take all the clothes off, the screaming stops. So to come back to your question, babies do actually have a higher basal temperature. The fat they carry around them in those first several months is a different kind of fat called a brown fat that actually just burns more energy. And so, yes, I usually say dress your baby just slightly more than you would dress it than your dress. So if everyone is walking around in tank tops, you know, you shouldn't be putting layers and layers on your baby. They're just going to be uncomfortable. It will affect their sleep. The temperature actually when your baby for the room could be somewhere about 65 to 72 degrees that you set that thermostat at. And that's, you know, 65 is pretty on the cool side. And remember, also, we're encouraging babies not to sleep in blankets and all of that, you know, but just a simple one-piece outfit or a simple light swaddler when they're still newborns. So, yes, you certainly don't want to. I think there's, I'm not sure where it comes from, but I think it's just an instinct. I think they still look so fragile that you're just afraid they're going to freeze to death.
I think it came from my mom. I think she's been spreading that around.
Blame it on your mom.
So, yeah, along those lines, do they need socks? Do they have to wear socks? If we're in flip-flops?
They don't have to. They don't have to. I think it's, again, one of those things where we just feel like we want to. Now, of course, if it's winter time, yes, slap socks on them, right?
Right.
But, yeah, they don't absolutely have to. I think it just makes us more comfortable than anything. I will say, which is also another condition oftentimes that can be shocking sometimes, is a condition called acrocyanosis, which is where the palms and the soles of a baby, the vessels are so tiny that you don't have a lot of blood flow into the area. And so they can look kind of bluish, purplish. And if the temperature of the room is on the cooler side, it can be like really stark yellow, purple, like really look very, like almost like there's no blood supply there. And that can be quite dramatic, but it's not dangerous. Now, socks and mittens might help that a little bit, just warm up the extremities so there's more blood flow to the area. But yeah, it's not an absolute necessity.
Okay, so they don't have great nods because they're purple. They just have smaller, less blood flow and smaller capillaries that are filling those spaces.
That's correct.
Okay.
Plus, baby feet are the best thing to kiss. So, right? Like, if you have socks on them, how are you going to get to them?
Right.
Them?
Well, and usually one falls off and gets lost anyway,
it's
right?
So
you've got one sock. You know. Okay, so talk about the umbilical cord stump. I have a funny story. Mm-hmm. So we were taught to, you know, soak a cotton ball with alcohol and, you know, put it on there like every time we changed the diaper to help dry up the stump so it would fall off. So I was doing that with our second, and by his, I don't know, maybe 6-week checkup, he still had a stump. And the pediatrician said, well, this is the strangest thing, that his stump has not fallen off. And so, you know, he's like just, you know, dousing it in alcohol, you know. And so we were staying at my parents' house because we were in the middle of a move, like I said before. And so I checked the expiration date, and it had expired 6 years prior. So really, I'd been pouring water on my kid's umbilical stump for 6 weeks. Like, just water, keeping it moist.
Just water.
Yeah. Anyway, what is the guidance there? How long should it, when should it fall off naturally? What do we do?
Well, you may feel a little less guilty to know that the recommendation now is just water is fine.
You are so ahead of your time, Amy.
I knew it.
I'm going to go back and tell that pediatrician. He didn't know what he was talking about, yelling at me like that.
There are actually some studies that show it didn't really matter what you did. If you use alcohol, if you use just water, if you just left it alone, if you use death and violet like they used to use in the old days, also the purple dye, that it all just feels just fine for the most part. And maybe the difference may be 1 or 2 days it falls up earlier, one over the other. It wasn't anything significant. But typically, it will fall up anywhere from several days when it falls up really quickly. It's about 2 weeks usually. You know, past 2 weeks, yes, you're beginning to wonder if there's something else going on, because sometimes some conditions can cause that to be delayed. But usually by 2 weeks, 3 weeks max, most of them have fallen off. Yeah. And sometimes they've actually detached, but it just stuck to the skin. So it's actually detached, but just stuck to the overlying skin. And you may just need to sort of wet it a little bit for it to come off.
I love how so much of what you talk about is you can do it this way or you can do it that way. You can do, you know, you can be water or you can do alcohol. Socks, no socks, you know, like it's hard to mess it up. And so much of what you do is just about making parents feel comfortable or moms feel comfortable with their baby. So talk to us about what you call the confident mom mindset and why is that so important?
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. I think just over the years of taking care of newborns, like I said, I've been practicing for 17 years now. And if you talk about just that first newborn visit with the mom, I've done well over 2,000 of those at this point. So I have noticed that moms who are just better in tune with themselves and who have what I've come to just call the confident mom mindset, just do a better job or just seem to have an easier time caring for the newborn. And when you boil it down, I sort of feel there are three pillars to it. And one is, first of all, just knowing that you're the best mom for your baby, right? However this baby has come to you by natural birth or adoption, you're the best mom for this baby. It's not going to be the mom next door. It's not going to be your mom or your sister or somebody else. It's just going to be you, right? And the evidence of that is that the baby was given to you, however that baby came to you, right? Mm-hmm. And so first of all, and one really actually has to sit with that thought for a while for it to have full impact. Because I think you can just brush that off. Yeah, I'm the best mom for my baby. But no, you really are the best mom for your baby, which means that you really have everything it takes to care for this baby. You may not have all the information you need, but you are able to go get that information from a place of strength and empowerment than feeling like, oh my God, I didn't know what to do. I'm terrible at this. I suck at this. You know, can someone please help me out here? But more like, oh, you know, I'm the best mom for this baby. I need some information. I need to go get some information. I'm going to reach out to this person or this resource to get that information I need for this newborn, this baby that I'm well equipped to take care of, right? It's knowing that you're in charge of your baby's care, like I talked about earlier on, and knowing that, yes, I agree with you that a lot of what we worry about and what moms worry about oftentimes really doesn't matter when you look at the big scheme of things. And I'm not sure if it's also just the fact that I didn't grow up in a resource country. The fact is babies grow up in all kinds of environments around the world, right? And they thrive and they survive, right? And yes, some parts of the world have a higher mortality rate, but by and large, you know, babies do well. They're quite resilient. So I think when a mom realizes that much of what she worries about probably doesn't have a big difference at the end of the day, make a big difference at the end of the day, she's better able to just relax and really try and be more intuitive to what feels right for her and her baby and her family. Because you can have a mom who feels like, I really need to breastfeed because everyone says I need to breastfeed, but that process is so traumatic that you're not emotionally available for your child. But at the end of the day, the child actually suffers more than if you had just formula fed, because that felt just more true to you and just was much easier to handle. And that could be vice versa also. So I think at the end of the day, you want a mom who is just confident in her ability to care for this baby and to get the resources she needs to care for this baby, and not worry as much about what everybody else is saying. Absolutely, you want to listen. You certainly want to get good information. You want to seek out good information. And I tell my moms, you know, you reserve the right to change your mind. If you get new information down the road that feels like, hey, well, you know what? I thought that, yeah, that was crap. I'm going to do this instead now. Feel free to change your mind, right? It's there isn't, yeah, I think we just need to give ourselves more grace.
So you say that education is self-care.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that.
You know, I think when we think about self-care, we're thinking of 2 hours or half a day at a spa, like, you know, this really luxurious sort of experience, and all of that could very well be self-care as well. But I think when you think about just the phrase itself, self-care, you're just caring for yourself. It means you're giving yourself whatever you need. And for a new mom, that could just be drinking more water. That could be like going for a 10, 15 minute walk just to be with yourself. That could be, you know, going to a coffee shop with your significant other to catch a drink and drink something that's, you know, comfortable for you and you're breastfeeding, if you're breastfeeding. Just simple things like that, but it's caring for yourself. And sometimes caring for yourself also is realizing that I do need information, right? I need information to be able to function at my best in whatever area it is I'm looking at. And so I need to get that information. And so I say education is self-care also, because you are going out to seek the education you need to care for yourself. You care enough for yourself to go seek what you need to be able to effectively do what you're trying to do, which might be in this case, for instance, taking care of a newborn.
I love
like
that.
Putting on your oxygen mask first, right?
Yes,
take care of
yes.
yourself so you can take care of them. What kinds of advice or what kinds of things should people think about if they're looking for a pediatrician? That's a huge decision. And like you yes. talked about, Amy, I've moved a couple times and had to look for a pediatrician. So what do you tell parents when they're looking for a pediatrician?
I think having done this long enough, I would say, first of all, if you're still in the city you grew up in and your pediatrician is still around and you had a wonderful time with them, just go back.
Yeah.
They'll be happy to take care
I love
of you.
That.
Baby. Easy decision. Go back to the same guy who's taking care of lady who's taking care of you for like 20 years. but really, I think one of the maybe underutilized resources is actually going to visit the pediatrician. And so oftentimes there's just so much going on in preparing for a baby's arrival that you don't even think about a pediatrician until they've asked you at labor and delivery, who's the pediatrician going to be? And you're like, oh my God, I didn't even choose one. Where's your list? Okay, mini, mini, mani, mo, we'll choose that one. But yeah. If you do take out time to actually go get this information or to make that decision early enough, one of the best things you can do is actually just go sit down with the person or have a virtual meeting, you know, over Zoom or some video conferencing, where you can actually just get to sit with the person and just sort of get their energy, their vibe. You can get to ask them about what their philosophy is for caring for, you know, a newborn. Very open-ended question, but the real answer it can be quite informative. You can get a sense of if this is someone that will be supportive with whatever I decide to do, the breastfeeding mom, are they going to be supportive of that? You know, if I want to formula feed, are they going to be supportive of that? I think just you get a better sense of the person. I think one question to ask also is what their stance on vaccines are, because pediatricians sometimes have fallen on two sides now, where I wouldn't see you if you don't vaccinate on schedule, or I will see you regardless of what you decide. I'll provide the information you need and allow you to choose. But it's important. I only mention that because it's important, because if you start to see a pediatrician but realize that I don't want to vaccinate and now I can't see them anymore, or vice versa, that can be, you know, traumatic to start to look for someone else. So I think just going to visit is one big place to start. You certainly want to look at how far away it is from where you live and how the logistics of getting there. In that first year of life, you might have anywhere from 6 to 8 to even 10 visits, depending on what's going on with your newborn. So that's a lot of trips to the office. So, you know, if you choose a pediatrician who's 2 hours away, you know, that's okay if you're okay with making that, you know, committing to that commute those many times those first few years. So that's something to look into. Of course, looking at insurance, if you're going to be using medical insurance, you need to take your insurance. So those are a few things. But I think the big thing is going to be, you know, sitting down with the person if you can. Also, finding out what resources they have after hours. You know, is there going to be someone that can be really worried that I can call and talk to? That may be also helpful.
Yeah, those are
a few things to think about.
Yeah, I love that you brought up vaccines, because I wanted to ask you that as well. And so, you know, if you look at the hospital patient bill of rights, right, at almost any hospital, one of the rights that every patient has is to refuse treatment.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you can't, somebody can't force treatment upon you.
Yeah.
And so if a pediatrician refuses to see you because you've chosen not to vaccinate your children or to vaccinate them on a different schedule, is that removing a parent's autonomy and their right to choose for their child? Or, like, what guidance have pediatricians been given so that they have been able to make this decision themselves? Like, where do you, like, and you don't have to say where you stand, but talk about that situation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, some of it just goes down to how polarized we are these days in society, honestly. And I will say, back to your initial question, if you look at it in some ways, you still haven't taken away the mom's or dad's or, you know, parents' decision to vaccinate or not vaccinate, because they can just go somewhere else and seek for someone who maybe is more supportive of that decision at that time. I think that a pediatrician is there to provide information and to provide good information, to really encourage. I think that, and this may just be a general life philosophy, I think there's no place for browbeating someone over something that's not life-threatening. And there could be arguments on both sides of the fence, for sure. And I think there are valid arguments on both sides of the fence. But we're not talking about, in this case, a child, for instance, who needs insulin because they have type 1 diabetes, right? So I think, unfortunately, we're just in the time, would say, polarized, whatever that word is. And so, yeah, but I would just say that's why it's important for you to take out time ahead of time to find medical providers that are supportive of you and can provide information in a very non-judgmental, non-threatening way, so that you can make the best decision.
Good advice. Okay, so we need to take a quick break, let Dr. Jody read a word from our sponsor. And when we come back, we want to hear about, you know, your specific resources, how, you know, listeners can learn more from you and what you have to offer them when we come back.
Are you concerned about your child's reading or spelling performance? Are you worried your child's reading curriculum isn't thorough enough? Well, most learning struggles aren't the results of poor curriculum or instruction. They're typically caused by having cognitive skills that need to be strengthened. Skills like auditory processing, memory, and processing speed. LearningRx one-on-one brain training and structured literacy programs are designed to target and strengthen the skills that we rely on for reading, spelling, writing, and learning. LearningRx can help you identify which skills may be keeping your child from performing their best. The LearningRx team would like to help get your child on the path to a brighter and more confident future. Join the growing list of more than 100,000 children and adults trained at LearningRx. Give LearningRx a call at 866-BRAIN-01 or visit learningrx.com. That's learningrx.com.
And we're back talking to Dr. Emeka Obidi about issues that new and expectant moms typically face and what his advice is for what to do about those issues. But you actually have a course. Tell our listeners about that.
Sure. So I have a course. It's called the Newborn Preparation Course, and it's really designed to be able to come alongside expectant parents or recently delivered moms and to encourage them, help them understand what to expect with their newborns, help them release mom guilt, this so they can really enjoy the newborn. So it's a 4-week course. It's 1 hour for 4 consecutive weeks. We cover everything from what to expect right after delivery, what to expect with feeding, what to expect after you make that decision if you're not sure. We talk about sleep and what that looks like and how mom can try to maximize her rest during that period. It's obviously a very trying period for sure. We talk about how to handle things if things don't go as planned. We talk about how to visit a pediatrician, how to maximize those visits to a pediatrician, just a bunch of how to get support systems around you. So a bunch of different topics that I've just found over the years I think are helpful. How to recognize those critical things you need to be able to recognize that may indicate something is wrong with your newborn. And how a bunch of different things also that are sort of just minor variations of normal that oftentimes moms can worry about that are normal. So we cover a bunch of things that and there's, depending on when you listen to this, there might be a wait list for when it's offered next. It's offered quarterly. And so you can always sign up for the wait list for when next it's going to be, when next we're going to offer it, when next enrollment is open.
And how many meetings or sessions is that?
So there are 4 sessions with me, and then I do have guest sessions. So I have one session with a breastfeeding consultant, a physician, and another session with a sleep physician, just addressing just sleep in and of itself. There's a session with a doula, just to sort of expose people to the services that a doula provides and preparing them for delivery and also postpartum care as well. But all those are still offered within the 4 weeks. And in very small, bite-sized lessons, it's usually a trying period when the mom is pregnant, so you don't want to keep her sitting for hours consuming that information. And of course, there are replays to all the lessons as well.
Yes, because that pregnancy brain.
I was going to say that.
For you, yeah. I used to call that PIS, pregnancy-induced stupidity.
I stayed out of that one.
I know. I was talking about myself, like when I realized I can remember sitting in my office and picking up the phone to call somebody. And by the time like they actually picked up, I forgot who I was holding for. So I would keep a notepad next to my phone. Right. This is who I'm calling and why.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
So, and you have a couple of free e-guides that people can download too, don't you?
Yes.
Tell us how people can get those.
Absolutely. Hopefully there might be a link, you know, where they watch this, but there's a resource guide for how to choose a pediatrician. And I just go through some very simple framework to that. And then there's also the Confident Mom Resource Guide, which really covers some of what we just talked about and really sort of prepares mom for that process. And they can access the resources on newbornprepacademy.com. It's newbornprepacademy.com. There's a wait list on there for the course, and there's a link for the resources as well.
Wonderful.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, we need to let Dr. Obidi go because he has a patient. So we're going to wrap this up. But this has been a fantastic conversation with Dr. Emeka Obidi. We just want to thank you for sharing your wisdom and this amazing set of tips that you've given new and expectant moms today. We hope that you'll come back because I'm sure you have so much more that we could ask you about and that our listeners would benefit from.
It has been a thrill to be with you guys. Thank you so much for having me on, and I would be glad to come back on.
Awesome. That would be great. Listeners, if you'd like more information about Dr. Obidi's work, his website is newbornprepacademy.com. You can find him on Facebook at Dr. Emeka Obidi and on Instagram at Dr. Obidi. We'll put all those links, how to spell them, all his handles in the show notes for you. So thank you so much for listening today. If you like us, please follow us on social media. We're on every channel at The Brainy Moms. If you would rather watch us, we are on YouTube. And if you want to be a guest on our show or suggest a guest for our show, you can email me directly, Dr. Amy at learningrx.com, or you can visit brainymoms.co. So look, until next time, we know that you're busy moms and we're busy moms. So we're out.
Have a good one, everyone.